The history of Minnesota comedy. That's what's coming up on The Art of Bombing, episode 189.
My friend Dan, he's got a podcast, 'cause all comics need a podcast, and nobody had a podcast called The Art of Bombing. So Dan went out and bought a tape deck. Who knows why he bought a tape deck? Podcasts don't get played on tape decks, but Dan is from the 80s. So hey there, all you funny jerks, come talk to Dan about your work. Tell him all about your worst times. It's The Art of Bombing.
Welcome to a brand new episode of The Art of Bombing. Dan Bublich Jr. here with you again today, Tuesday, February 9th, 2021. Another week is behind us in the dust, but that's okay because we have a great episode for you today. I had a fantastic guest on the podcast this week. My guest is a writer. He's the founder of MinnesotaComedy.com, which is a media publication that covers comedy, comedians and comedy shows and the things of that nature that are happening in Minnesota. He was a writer for City Pages, and he just released a brand new book named The Funny Thing About Minnesota, which is a look at the history of comedy in Minnesota, because it goes way back into the 70s and probably even before that. I'm very excited to read his book, but we talked a little bit about his book. But we also talked about a lot of other things in comedy, because he kind of dabbled in comedy. He's been covering comedy, arts and entertainment in the Twin Cities area for, almost 15 years. So he had a lot of fun stories to talk about. He's seen a lot of comedy. He's seen some good comedy. He's seen some bad comedy. And we had a great conversation about the history of Minnesota comedy. And it was great. So that's what's coming up. It's going to be a good episode. I will mention before we get into this episode, if you're interested in purchasing the book, at the end of the show, he did tell you where you could get it. You can find it at your local bookstores. You can get it online. Pretty much wherever you can get books, you can get this book. But they're doing a virtual book release. That's right. On February 24th, 2021, they're going to be doing, the virtual book release. And he's got a lot of special guests, that are comedians that are featured in the book because they're part of the Minnesota history. Louis Anderson is going to be at this virtual book release. Scott Hansen, who is another comic that's pretty well known in the Twin Cities area. And there's a couple other people. I don't have all the names in front of me, but there's a couple other people that are going to be part of this virtual event. So I think you can stream it via Facebook, but if you just go to Facebook and you search Funny Thing About Minnesota, you will find that virtual event. So you can hear Patrick talk about his book with the people that he wrote the book about, the people that were the four founders of Minnesota comedy. So, all right, I think that's enough of the promotion and the intro. We should get into this great conversation. Lastly, if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the podcast. Hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to the podcast. It helps if you can leave a review, wherever you listen to this, if they allow you to leave a review. If you could leave a 5-star rating, maybe give us a nice review, that'd be cool too. You can find previous issues wherever you get podcasts, or if you want to make it simple, you can just go to the website, artofbombingpod.com. And we got some fun stuff over there. In addition to previous episodes, there's blogs and all kinds of insight on comedy over at the website. Or you could join our Facebook group or follow us on all social media platforms at Art of Bombing Pod. All right, that's enough of this business. Here's my conversation with Patrick Strait. Enjoy. Like we were talking about before we hit record about the pandemic and getting, everything that happened there and trying to adapt, that's something I kind of saw, and I feel bad for, because there's a lot of comics that still, they're against virtual comedy and they don't think it'll last. And I get it. I understand it's a way different to perform virtually, but even after things get back to somewhat whatever normal is, I feel like it's still going to be there. And
yeah,
it's good. It's a good skill set. It's another thing to have in your toolbox, really.
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally. No, it's funny. I have a friend who he's probably extreme of people who are, you know, kind of freaked out about pandemic and germs and COVID and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, like, you know, I asked him, I'm like, well, you know, once you get the vaccine, like, are you going to like kind of take your time and go back out? You think you're going to start doing stuff again? And he's like, I don't know. He's like, even though like I know I'm technically safe, he's like, I think just mentally getting myself to be like comfortable being out in like big public gatherings and stuff. He's like, that's going to take a while. So no, I totally agree with you. Like, it's going to be a weird mental transition for all of us, I think. So
absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Totally agree with that. Who knows what's going to happen. I just, like I said,
for sure,
you just have to adapt. And that's with anything. You know, I've had some conversations with people online too. I saw somebody did a big post about how, you know, creators are succumbing to the limitations of the algorithms of, you know, social media platforms and stuff like that. And it's like, and so I replied to this bit because he quoted me on something because I was talking about YouTube Shorts in a Facebook group. And
sure.
I was like, well, I think you're looking at it in the wrong way. You know, to me, I'm not adapting to social media to their algorithms. I'm using it as a tool to help market myself to sell my product because, you know, that's what we are. We're our own products and we got to be able to sell it. So.
Yeah. I mean, it might be idealistic to say, but like at the end of the day, if you're good and you're putting out good stuff, like people will find it eventually. Mm-hmm. Like there's people who will get really like, oh, well, I'm never going to be able to get famous or get this out there because of the algorithm. I'm like, or your stuff just sucks because like the thing is if you're good enough, you'll get around the algorithm. People will come looking for it. People will tell people about it. Like just because you're not, you know, a featured TikTok or something, like, that's not going to be the reason why your career like makes it or breaks it. You know what I mean? Like that's always kind of been my attitude. Like I understand like, you know, the importance of like pushing out consistent content, like what you're doing, right? I mean, putting out like the podcasts and having, you know, virtual mics and doing these things. But I'm like, at the end of the day, like talent's going to come to the top. Like, you know, cream rises to the top type deal where it's like, if something is good and it's worth watching, people will find it and it will find its viewership, you know, whether or not Facebook or Instagram or YouTube or TikTok or whoever the case is, you know, decides to give you that boost is besides the point. So it might just be how they find it. So I get you.
Yeah, I totally agree with that too. And I think that's the thing too. It's important to, you know, to put some stuff out there, but also be consistent, you know, and I feel like that's the difference, you know, with a lot of people, like a lot of comics and just people in general, you know, because I've been studying marketing. So I really watch, I spend a lot of time watching TikTok and different things just because I'm watching what's popular and what's popping up in my, you know, my For You page and this and that. And what I've, you know, the biggest takeaway is that everybody's trying to be famous. That's all they want. They want to just be famous on TikTok. And I'm like, yeah, but what do you do with that? Because what happens when the app shuts down? Then you know, or whatever, you know, terms of service and things on how they change or different things like that. What are you going to do? I mean, and a lot of the stuff, especially on TikTok, it ain't even that great of content. It's mostly just, it's a lot of women just taking off their clothes. I mean, that's a lot of what comes up and dancing and lip syncing to other people's creative things, you know, that kind of thing. And outside of TikTok, and I know people are making, you know, some of them creators end up getting paid, good for them. But outside of that, what are you going to do with it? Where I look at it as like, well, I'm hoping if I can build a little bit of a following or, you know, build some social presence when I get to go perform live again, hopefully people that have seen some of this content will be like, oh, I saw him on TikTok or Instagram Reels. I want to go see him live now. You know, they're all just trying to find that instant fame, and unfortunately, it doesn't last.
Yeah, no, I mean, look at Vine, look at all those Vine creators who were like super famous who all just vanished.
Yeah,
I mean, like some of them transitioned into being like, you know, I don't know, Instagram stars or whatever the case is, but there was so many kids who were like Vine mega stars, and now, like, I don't know what they're doing, like, they're 15 minutes over and they hadn't transitioned, like you said. It's kind of like that old, I mean, like talking about comedy, it's kind of like that old adage, right? Where Now I feel like some comics are very focused on like, hey, when you get on TV or when you get a special, that's like, that's the pinnacle, right? Like that's when you made it. And I know that a lot of comics from the old days and even now who look at it are like, getting a special is kind of like the equivalent of getting a really nice polished commercial. Cause the idea is you want to get people who will come find you. They'll come watch you when you come to town, they'll come buy tickets to your shows. They'll buy albums. They'll do all this kind of stuff. Having a really important and really big and really famous special is awesome, but it can't be the end all be all. Cause like you said, it's like at some point that's not going to be new. It's not going to be fresh. Like people are going to have seen it and been like, okay, but what else you got? And if you don't got it, that's the end of your fame. So no, I totally get that.
Yep. And it's about building, and it's about building drawability. I mean, exactly what you're talking about, you know, before social media and before the internet, you know, getting on TV or getting a special, you know, like on HBO or Showtime and all the, you know, or getting on the late night shows, that helped comics boost comics careers, not because they got to be like, oh, I was on TV, but then people saw them and that was draw. You know, they could go to a club and people would come see them because they saw this little sample, if you will, like you said, the commercial version of them.
Right.
And that's the same. And then like you know, because this was one of my arguments and when I was replying to this person, as I said, you know, YouTube, that's how it used to be. But now YouTube and the internet came along and people don't need those gatekeepers. There's a lot of Hollywood gatekeepers that were preventing very talented people from being on TV because whatever reason. And while now you don't need them, you can do it yourself. With, you know, these if you're using these as the different social media platforms as marketing tools, you know, because you can build a following. I mean, look at there's so many comedy clubs that because at the end of the day, they're a business. They need to make sales, whether it's ticket, drinks, you know, beverages, food, whatever. They're trying to make a profit. And a lot of comics get upset because these comedy clubs will bring in these YouTube stars that don't really have an act of any sort of thing, you know. And it usually ends up being a crappy show, but the people that go, they know this person. That's why they're there. And they have a good time because they knew what they were getting into, whether the person was a good performer or not. They didn't care.
Oh yeah.
But they sell out. So can you really get mad? I mean, I get it. Seriously. It's frustrating. But like, I mean,
what's his name? My favorite example is, you know who Joe Dombrowski is, right?
The name sounds familiar.
So it's he actually went to high school with my sister, is why I know the name. But he was the guy. So there was a clip. It went super viral. And I think he ended up on Ellen a few years ago. Basically, he was like the elementary school teacher that did like a spelling test and he made up all the words. And it went super viral. And so, you know, she had him on the show. He had his 15 minutes of fame. So he's a stand-up. I mean, he comes out here. He pretty regularly like House of Comedy, like once or twice a year. Every show. And if you go see him do stand-up, he's a really funny stand-up. I had no idea the guy did stand-up comedy before that because I was like, oh, he's a elementary school teacher who made a funny video. But I mean, you know, and this is maybe not the best, you know, benchmark, but like my mom went and saw this guy do comedy. My mom is not a comedy fan. She's not internet for, you know, clips and things like that. But she saw this guy and she's like, oh, he was really funny when I saw his video that he made in his elementary room classroom on Ellen. And so she went and saw his show. So like, you know, he's making tickets off of my mom, so to speak. So that's the perfect example of it. And he's probably, like you said, I mean, there's for every one of him who is actually a very good stand-up, there's probably 10, like you said, YouTube stars and stuff like that who probably, they probably do suck. But at the same time, like you said, like, I mean, if they're going to sell tickets and they can get people in there, you know, there's another really weird phenomenon happening right now with professional wrestlers who are all becoming stand-up comedians.
Oh, yeah. That's actually been like a trend in the last like 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. So like that's another thing where I'm like, you know, it's so weird to see that like these guys who, you know, like I'm 38. So who were like big in like, you know, 2000 when I was in high school are like doing stand-up now. So it's funny. It's like you said, I mean, there's definitely no one traditional path anymore. And I think that's, you know, I mean, except for me, who's obviously on here begging you to give me a podcast spot. But aside from that,
except you didn't beg me. I asked you.
who's keeping track? Who's keeping track?
Yeah. That's something, too, with wrestling, because wrestling, you know, when I lived in California, I had a lot of friends that were not just into indie wrestling, but they were indie wrestling. Like, I had a friend who was a comic, and he's a comedian and an impressionist, voice actor. He also does wrestling. He had his own wrestling company for a little while, and I did some stuff with him. But I saw they're two different – even though they're two different industries, they align very closely. Like, the paths are very similar. But yeah, it's interesting to see all these comics like transition over, you know. And I think it with like Mick Foley is a good example of, you know, he does a lot of, but he does more like stories and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, they can sell tickets and they can sell out clubs, and that's, you know, kind of what it's about. And I've seen, you know, I watched Rob Van Dam dabbled in comedy a little bit. And he, I mean, he did good. I mean, he was fine. Like, I wasn't the greatest stand-up comic I've ever saw, but he wasn't terrible either, you know? And I mean, it was actually funny because he mostly just went in and roasted comedians. Like, he was just making fun of us and you know, comedians and things like that. And it ended up being, you know, fairly entertaining, but... And I think that's another thing when it comes to, you know, this stuff is that... It's also about being entertaining, you know? Like, their fans, the people that are coming, aren't going to give two shits if he's funny or not. They're just glad that they get to be there and have that live experience with their favorite wrestler or their favorite YouTuber or, you know, whatever they got famous doing.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, I think it's funny because, like, they kind of have an advantage. I'm curious to get your take on this as a comic, right? Because if I'm like, you know, I'm a pro wrestler and I'm going to start doing stand-up, even if I'm bombing my ass off, I know my audience enough where I can just tell some, even if it's not the funniest story, I can tell a behind-the-curtain wrestling story and I'm going to have everybody captivated, right? Same thing with YouTubers, right? I mean, like, they know what videos and what topics have gotten a ton of traffic. And so they can just start talking about the same sort of thing and they've already got an audience. Whereas as a comic, you know, obviously there's always, you know, you'll do – proven material and you'll see comics who've had specials who occasionally slide stuff in from their specials, but you show up at a comedy club and even if everybody's like, oh man, I'm a huge Dan Bublis fan, and then you start doing, you know, everything off of your last special or bits that they've already seen, everybody's like, this sucks, I've seen this, like, you can't do the same thing you've talked about. So it's almost like, you know, these I guess content creators, for lack of a better term, or, you know, these folks who don't come from a comedy background, they kind of have a built-in, you know, following. Like, they kind of have a crutch they can be on that I think a lot of stand-ups don't get to have, which is interesting. And so that's another, you know, it's and again, I mean, I'm asking you more than I'm trying to comment on it. I think from the standpoint of a comic, I don't know if I would be upset because I'd be like, hey, you know, this is something that I've worked at for 10 years, you know, doing open mics and working on 3-minute bits and trying to put stuff together to have a full set. Jake the Snake Roberts can come in and tell me some gross story about the time that Andre the Giant broke a bathroom and that guy is going to sell out a 250 person club. You know what I mean? So I don't know. It's, I mean, like you said, I mean, you have a, I think, perspective on it where you understand the business side, but I think a lot of comics would probably approach it from like a, you know, hey, you're not a comic, you're just a guy and you're taking a spot from me. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah. And it's true. I mean, that is exactly how a lot of comics do look at it. It's a spot that they didn't get. But then I always look at it, you got to take a step back and ask yourselves this. What have you gotten that spot, you know, to begin with? You know, are you at that level? Are you, I mean, if you were at that level that you could draw 250 people and they would be totally captivated for an hour while you were talking, whether you were funny or not, Jake the Snake Roberts wouldn't be replacing you at the club.
That's true.
You know, I mean, that's another perspective that we don't, you know, a lot of times people don't do that, take that step back and ask these questions, you know, because, and while, it's an easy built-in audience for them, but they're not necessarily, just because they're performing in a stand-up club, they're not always billing themselves as doing stand-up comedy. It just gets, it's like an auto, almost like an auto, I can't think of a word, but where they just, people just automatically assign because they're performing in a club that it's stand-up comedy. When, you know, a lot of these wrestlers, they're not, they have funny stories, but they're not trying to be a pure stand-up. They're going in and telling stories about, the behind the curtain type of stuff, and that's what their audiences want. They want, they're basically, mm-hmm. you know, it's like a big long Q&A essentially.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't matter if it was at a comedy club or at a wrestling convention or just some random venue that decided to have a wrestler come in and talk for an hour. People would mm-hmm. still go, you know, go to those venues. And so the way I look totally. At it, if a comedy club can profit off that, which means then they're going to stay open, because comedy is mm-hmm. a tough business. It was a tough business before the pandemic. And now, right. even more so, there's a lot of comedy clubs that are struggling. A lot of comedy clubs that have closed and aren't mm-hmm. coming back because of this. So yeah. I look at it as if they can make some money and that helps them stay open, that's potentially a spot that I'm going to get in the future, because somebody else could draw better than me. You know, like
totally. No, and I think, like, to bring it full circle back to what we started this for, I think that's – I mean, you're doing this, right? I mean, a lot of comics are catching on the fact that it's almost about, like, how do I create enough content and have enough things out there that I'm a captivating enough personality that people are going to want to come see me regardless of what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at even comedians, right? I mean, like, Dave Chappelle doesn't do jokes really that much anymore. I
no,
feel like if you
he just talks.
He just gets up and talks about whatever's going on. Half the time you'll watch a Chappelle special and it's – you won't laugh for 90% of it, but you're drawn in. Like, you want to listen, mm-hmm. and it's because he has enough stuff out there, you know him enough, where nobody's sitting there like, all right, you know, make me laugh, clown. I'm like, you've got 45 minutes, get up there and do your jokes. It's the personalities. And I think yep. what you're doing with the show, I think what, you know, like we've talked about, what even those content creators that we were kind of picking at the beginning, you know, whether that's wrestlers or TikTokers or YouTubers, if it's somebody who I'm like, I know that I like this person and they have a perspective, I'm interested. Like, I want to see it. And I think, to your point, I think especially post-pandemic, it's going to be really interesting to see how a lot of people kind of pivot and shift, especially because I feel like, you know, and you know this better than anybody, it's kind of been a big reset, right, as far as the industry is concerned. I mean, everybody's kind of been in the same spot for the last year for the most part. So it's like, yeah, you can work on jokes and do material and things, but it's mostly going to be like, okay, what's your experience been like for the last year? And like, what's it like connecting with people in the new world? So I mm-hmm. think it's going to be interesting.
No, I totally agree. It is going to mm-hmm. be, it's going to be interesting to see how things go. And the one thing, and there's definitely some positive, there will be negatives, I'm sure, but there's definitely some positives, because one thing that I saw right away when this happened and people started doing some stuff virtually, and I said it several times on this podcast, and I should have copyrighted or patented the idea so I could have sold it to them. But I was like, if I was a comedy club, I'd be incorporating virtual shows. Not
oh, big time.
Like, as ticket sales, like mm-hmm. bring in your reduced capacity audiences, but also open it up to, you know, Zoom shows. And a lot of clubs ended up doing that. And I think that's great, because now in post pandemic, they can, now that they have the technology and they know how to do it and they worked out all the kinks, they can keep mm-hmm. it on there. So when a comic comes in and, you know, big name comic sells out the club, now they have capacity to make more money because they can sell discounted virtual tickets and sell even more. So, you know,
absolutely.
And it's just another way for another revenue stream, which then helps keep that club open. So there's places for comedians to perform, you know? So
yeah,
it'll definitely be interesting to see how
yeah.
they all do. But now I know you've dabbled in comedy a little bit, but mostly you've done a lot of comedy writing as far as a, how would you classify yourself? Entertainment reporter, or I guess
I would say that my past has heavily been an arts, culture, and comedy writer is what
okay.
I would say.
Perfect.
Kind of been the, I would say, and that's me making myself sound way more important than I am. I would say in the Twin Cities, at least, I've kind of been, you know, not to toot my own horn, but I've kind of been the foremost, I think, comedy reporter, beat writer, whatever you want to call it, for probably the last, you know, 10 to better part of 15 years, probably just covering kind of the scene. A lot of, you know, bigger national acts that come to town I'll talk with too, but really kind of digging deep into like what the Twin Cities comedy scene is all about, what makes it unique, who are the personalities, what are some of the shows, you know, some of the things that maybe, you know, you're not going to know about if you're just doing a casual, you know, if you're just, hey, it's Friday, I'm curious, maybe we should see some comedy. You know, this is going to be a little bit deeper. You know, who are some of those people who are starting to make some noise? Who are some of those people who I want to see, who I'm going to go out of my way to try to find, not necessarily just whoever happens to be at a mic that night, you know?
Yo, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good way to describe. And I, because it's funny because your name, when I moved up here, popped up a lot before I even, you know, before we met and talked and anything like that, because of that, because of all the writing that you do covering the, you know, especially comedy in the Twin Cities. Now, with that, I'm sure part of that means you've had to go see a lot of comedy and things like that, covering, you know, different comedians, things like that. I bet. Do you have some interesting stories about like some of the stuff you've seen? Or
I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, like you said, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know that I've ever felt like I had to go see comedy, which has been the nice thing about this, right? Like, I am genuinely, I mean, I feel like, and you know this better than anybody, because I mean, comedy is your whole life. I feel like at some point, if you have to do it, you burn out on it, and it's not fun anymore. It's not interesting.
Yep.
And I've been really, you know, fortunate that I've always been able to be in a position where comedy's still fun. You know, I like going to shows. I mean, has every show that I've gone to been a good show? Of course not. But like, I love watching comedy. I love watching comics. And I really still get charged up even talking about comedy. I mean, you and I just sitting here talking about this. I love talking about comedy. So like, you know, that's the first thing, which I think is interesting. You know, it's funny because, and I thought about this before we talked. So the best, and I don't know if we're allowed to name names, but I'm going to name names.
That's up to you.
Well, I'm naming names. But, the first ever stand-up comedy show I saw was the worst bomb I've ever seen in my entire life.
Oh, wow. And it
was Spade.
Who?
So, David Spade.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's what I thought you said, but that, I think I interrupted you laughing. But okay.
No, it's all good. And I'm curious, and you know, we can talk about this in a second. I'll tell you the story, but then I'm curious to get your take about this, because I know you and I have talked a lot, and obviously the whole, you know, point of this podcast is you talk about, you know, bombing, and there's so many reasons why a bomb can happen, right? Just have a weird audience. There's some unfortunate circumstances. You're just off. You say the wrong thing. Whatever it is.
Yep.
But what do you do in those situations? And I'm curious, I'm asking you, and I'm interviewing you in your own show.
That's all right.
In those situations, when you're the reason that you're bombing, like, it's your fault. Like, it's not like, I mean, have you ever been in one of those where you're like, no, this isn't them, this is me. Like, I'm either tanking, or, and maybe not you, maybe it's just somebody you've seen or you've known, but you're like, I'm tanking this, I'm mailing it in, whatever it is, and the audience figured it out. I mean, like, What's kind of your response in that situation? Well, I mean, have you ever been in it? Have you ever met a comic who's been in it? What do you think about that?
I definitely I've definitely been in that situation, and sometimes I'll just call myself out, especially like, you know, if a joke doesn't land and then I do another joke or whatever, and it just, because sometimes, and this is something with comedy that, you know, I've talked with other comics about, that, you know, you don't think about this, but sometimes an audience judges you before you even open your mouth. Just you walking up there, they could make a negative judgment about you and decide that they don't like you. And then they're not going to laugh. Because comedy, to me anyway, a lot of it comes – it's a likability. You know, I always look at it as, you know, comedy's a journey. And you're basically – you're going on a trip. You're the bus driver. All these people are your passengers. They're going to go anywhere you go if they like and trust you. And you got to build that right away. And then from there, you could say the crappiest thing. But if they like you and trust you, they'll laugh and go with you. So for me, when that happens, sometimes I just acknowledge it. I'm like, I can tell that you guys don't like me. But, you know, I have to do this time. So here we go, you know. And
for
just keep going through. I mean, I just had Andy Erickson on the podcast not too long ago, and her story that she was talking about was, you know, she talked about bombing on national television and how, you know, she was like, it was all me. It's all me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she knew it.
Yep.
She was like, my first joke just didn't land, and then my second joke didn't land, and then she talked about, then she just totally forgot her next joke and like almost had a panic attack, and she totally knew it was all on her. And fortunately, in that scenario, she turned it around, and it ended up working out in the positive. And then they did a bunch of fancy editing, she said. But
yeah, of course.
Yeah, of course. That's the one great thing about TV. They were
the
able
best
to
part
like
of TV. Well, let me tell you. So Oh, no, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so for a lot of times, I just kind of try to acknowledge it or make the best. Mm-hmm. I try to make the best of it because it's one of the things where it's like, I know now. Now, early on in my career, I probably would have freaked out, panicked, who knows. But now, especially after doing this podcast for so long and, you know, knowing that it's part of the process, I'm mm-hmm. just like, well, here we are. We're going to keep going. I can't just sure. leave, get mad and be like, oh, you guys suck and, you know, do that easy cop out. It wasn't me. It was you. You just didn't get that joke. My joke was too smart for you or whatever. And then put my tail between my legs and run off the stage because that's unprofessional. Yeah. You got to do your time, mm-hmm. especially when you're being paid. So I just sure. power through it.
Well, let me tell you, David Spade did not subscribe to that same theory back when I saw him when I was 18 years old. So it's funny. So this is real quick. So basically, you know, this is like 2000, right? I'd never been to a comedy club. I'm like, you know, barely 18, freshman in college. And so David Spade's like coming to, you know, Central Michigan University to stand up. And I know that David Spade is, you know, very talented. He's very well respected in terms of stand-up comedy and things like this. But this is Spade like – you know, and this is, he's still fairly fresh off of SNL. He's like 5 years off of Tommy Boy. So he's like a star, right?
Yep.
So kind of what we were talking about before, where we were talking about like celebrities or people who already have fame coming. He already had it made before he showed up. You know, people showed up at this show because they were excited to see him. Like if he just would have got up on stage and told a couple of stories, he would have probably been in the clear. Problem is I don't think that David Spade decided that – sorry, we got a cat. he decided that he didn't need to even do that much. Like I think he thought his mere presence was going to be enough. So he gets up and he starts off, you know, and he starts telling jokes, but he's just doing a bunch of premises and a bunch of setups, and then he's not finishing the jokes. So like he'll wow. do a premise like, you guys get it, and then he'll just move on to his next joke. And so oh, like wow. – like, oh, okay, this is, you know, it's funny. Again, we're all a bunch of dumb 18-year-olds. I'm not saying that about 18-year-olds. I'm saying that about me specifically, but 18-year-olds. So we're ready to laugh at whatever he's got. And after about the third time, we're like, this guy's not doing jokes. Like, what is happening here? And so people start to turn on him. And it also doesn't help that he's just getting blitzed on stage. I mean, this guy is – I think he drank like 9 beers the entire time he was on stage.
Wow.
So he's just getting blasted on stage. And so he's like kind of doing jokes and somebody will yell something out and he'll just like mumble and drink. And eventually about 20 minutes into the show, he was probably doing, you know, 40 minutes or something, crowd turns. And so now people are booing and now people are yelling. And I mean, you're talking about college kids who are just awful people to begin with.
Yeah.
So, at him anyways.
Some of the best bombing stories that have been told on this podcast took place at colleges.
So at some point, Spade decides, he's like, obviously something clicks in his head where he's like, okay, this is going too far. I want to get them back. Like, I need to get the crowd back, right? And so he starts, like I said, this is probably about 5 years removed from, like, Tommy Boy. So out of nowhere, no setup, no, like, transition, he starts doing Fat Guy Little Coat from Tommy Boy. And he's like, hey, you guys remember that Fat Guy Little Coat? And this one guy stands up from the audience, and this is in like a little mini college arena, so there's probably 1,000 people here, and he just goes, that's not your fucking bit. And everybody loses it.
Oh,
laughs
wow.
so hard, because, and you can just see him sit there like he was like he tried to steal Chris Farley's joke, it felt like, and he got called out. And then everybody starts booing him, and this guy keeps going. He's just like, you were the worst part of that movie, Black Sheep sucked. He's just
oh no,
off on David Spade. It was incredible to watch this like mega star just crumble inward on stage. So
wow.
Not that I would ever want to take pride in watching somebody bomb, but he earned it that night. Like he came in with all the goodwill in the world and he made the decision to just tank it, and he paid the price for it. And that was my first ever comedy show.
Wow.
I'd never
seen. And you still decided to pursue a career in writing about comedy.
It was a while after that, you know. But so that was the first time I saw stand-up. But, you know, to jump ahead, so to answer your questions, you know, I moved to Minnesota about 14 years ago. And at that point, I'd seen a handful of stand-up shows, but you know, I was from Michigan. So, like, we had, like, a comedy club. Like, there's a comedy club in Royal Oak, Michigan called Mark Ridley's Comedy Castle, yep. which is
one of the most well-known
shows there. Yeah, absolutely. Great club. But it didn't really have – or Michigan, I should say, as a whole, didn't really have a scene. Like, you know, you don't hear it talked about. Like, it's, oh, you got to go to see this club or these are the performers from Michigan. You know, that wasn't really something that was talked about. So when I moved to Minnesota, the first weekend I lived here, my – girlfriend then wife for my excuse me my girlfriend turned wife turned ex-wife she was work, and so I had nothing to do. You know, I don't know anybody, I have no friends, so I'm just kind of trying to find, like, what do you do in downtown Minneapolis? And I live a mile from Acme, turns out. I've never heard of Acme, I've never been to Acme Comedy Company. And so I walked down there, and it was Alonzo Bowden, and it was it was my first time in, like, a real comedy atmosphere where, like, people were there to see comedy. And it wasn't like, you know how sometimes, like, I'll compare it to music, right? Like, you can go to a show because you're like, oh, there's a band playing, I want to go see it. Or you can go there because you're like, I want to see live music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it was. This wasn't like, let's go to the comedy club, it's something to do. It was, I want to see comedy. And it doesn't hurt that, you know, Alonzo Bowden's amazing. This guy's super talented. I think at that point he was fresh off of winning Last Comic Standing. So, like, he's already got all this pull. And so I'm sitting there and I'm watching him. He was great. But the other thing that was really crazy to me was, you know, he had these openers. You know, he had an MC who I believe was a woman named Amber Preston, who she's pretty well known in the Twin Cities.
Yep. She's out in California.
LA and yeah, here. And she was the MC. And I wish I could remember the feature. I can't. But I remember I was watching this and I was just like, wow. Like, you know, to me, this was like big time, because I'd never seen comedy in any real, like, setting beyond just, like, you know, what you see on TV, the occasional, you know, club show or like a big arena setting. So, like, to me, this is like superstars, right? Like, this is still crazy. You're on stage. I'm like, wow, like, these are big deal people. And so I started coming back, you know, pretty regularly, at least a couple times a month. And it was funny because this is when I first started recognizing some of the comedians who were around the scene a lot. And that's when it kind of first started to click for me that I'm like, oh, like, there's a comedy kind of scene here. Like, there's a group of people who do comedy regularly. And, like, it was kind of a cool feeling to go to an open mic night or to go to a show and to say, like, oh, wow, like, they're working on new stuff. Like, you know, I had never seen the comedy process before. You know, I was very much so, okay, you know, you see the final product on stage and that's how it goes. But, you know, when I first started going to club shows or to open mics, you know, there was like Tommy Ryman was somebody locally who was a real big name. He was doing it. Eric Allen. And then funny enough, the fact that you mentioned Andy Erickson. So, Dan, I'm going to tell you the truth. I don't know if I've ever actually mentioned this to anybody. So for about 15 minutes, I actually had, when I was like 25, had this big dream that I was going to try to do stand-up comedy. Because, of course, and it's super easy and anybody can do it. So that's why I was just going to do it. So I remember I went down to Acme and I, you know, if you've ever been to Acme Comedy Company, if you're local here, you know that the first time you do stand up, if you write a little star next to your name, that gets you on stage because you're a first timer.
Yep.
So I said, great. Okay, cool. I'm going to do it. So I go over, I put my name down. I'm all excited to go. And, you know, if you're a first timer, they put you at the beginning of the list. Yep. And so one or two people go and it's fine. And at this point, all the megalomaniac 25-year-old energy is just swirling in my head, right? I'm just like, oh, I'm going to be great. I'm going to be a star. Everybody's going to love me. The person who went right before me, it was their first time doing comedy as well, because we were all the first timers. And it was Andy Erickson. And her first time ever. And she went up and she decimated. I mean, she killed. To this day, you know, I've been seeing comedy for probably 20 years. I don't know that I've ever seen somebody kill as hard as Andy did that very first open mic night. She had like a small handful of friends, but she gets off stage. You know, they're all hugging her. Place went crazy. She was super funny. I mean, she's still super funny. Absolutely levels the room. And then the comedy debut of Patrick Strait. And I mean, how do you follow that? I mean, she's amazing. She's... Look at her. She's a headliner. She's been on TV. She knows John Stamos. Like, you can't argue with that. Like,
right?
Doing 3 minutes of God knows what. I think it was like around the time of like World Cup. I think I was trying to talk about Vuvuzelas. Remember those things?
Oh
man, it was fine. man. Like, I will say, my official first time in comedy, my official self rating was okay. It was fine. And I genuinely think that the only reason why I even got, like, a remotely good reaction was because Andy had already come in and done the hard part for me.
Yep.
So my claim to fame of the probably five times I've ever tried doing open mics is that, you know, Andy Erickson had to open for me her first time. So there you go.
I love it. That's a good way to look at it. I love that. Oh, yeah. It's funny because when she was on my podcast, I talked about that too. Like the one time I started stand up about 11 years ago. And within my first year, I came up before I moved to California. I came up to the cities and spent like 4 or 5 days up here just hitting open mics and stuff. And yeah. I went to Acme, did that same thing. But I remember her from that night. Like she stood out. And she's still like of all the comics that I met while I came up here, I mean, there's still quite a few that are around and I remember, but she really stood out from that open mic. I was just like memorized by how funny she was. Yes. And because her comedy can sometimes be a little different, which I think is great because it's a good variety or alter from, you know, what people think of stand up sometimes.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. So that was, yeah, I mean, that was, like you said, I mean, I've seen so many comics, so many stories like that. I mean, it's, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, I guess, depending on if you're one of the three people that genuinely enjoyed my comic stylings that night, it never really connected with the way it connected with some people. You know, the first time you did stand up, when you went up there and you did your open mic and you did your 3, 5, whatever it was, how many minutes you got, like when you got done, like how did you feel when you got done doing that set?
Well, I honestly, before I even had finished my set, and I've said this plenty of times, but I remember, I still remember it like it was yesterday when they called my name, I walked up to the stage and I had to overcome stage fright. I was in high school. I was not good at public speaking. I was not good at doing like any type of oral interpretation, any speeches in front of the classes. I got all nervous. I stuttered, whatever. So I really had to overcome that. But I remember when they called my name and I went up on stage, I grabbed the microphone through the bright lights. I looked out into the crowd and there was quite a few people at this open mic. There was like 60, 70 people. And I thought, you know, my first thought was, oh shit, what did I get myself into? I was just like, wow, this is, but I'm here. I got to go forward. And then I told a joke and I got, you know, the first laugh I got, as soon as I told a joke that got a laugh, which like you, I would say my first set was fine. I look at it as, and I still have it on YouTube because it's a nice, I like to watch it every year just to see how I progressed. To me, it was like, I didn't do terrible. I didn't do great. It was just fine. You know, like, I mean, I've had worse sets since that open mic.
But for sure.
And then after I got that first laugh, as soon as I got that first laugh, I said to myself, this is what I want to do. This is my new career path.
And
within a year, I moved out to California. So
absolutely. No, and I love it. And I mean, that's exactly, and I mean, that's what I've heard. You know, you said that so many people kind of say similar things where they were like, as soon as I did it, I'm like, this was it. Like this just filled them up and like gave them a feeling they'd never had before. And I didn't have that. Like I did it and I was like, that was okay. You know, I mean, it's one of those things where I was like, it's like people who, I don't know. What's an equivalent of people doing this? I guess it's like, I went and played mini golf. I was like, that was fun. I don't think I need to do it every single day, but it was all right.
Yep.
Stand-up comedy was to me. So that's how I know, you know, that stand-up comedy was not necessarily something that I wanted to personally pursue. But it's funny because kind of going back to, you know, just the writing stuff, I almost think in a way, you know, that's kind of why it allowed me to take on this position of kind of, you know, being the beat writer for comedy in the Twin Cities, because, you know, I didn't necessarily have any type of personal self-serving motivation. You know, I wasn't trying to make friends with club owners or bookers because I wanted to get set times. I wasn't trying to, you know, make connections with people because I was trying to get, you know, like tips or pointers. Mm-hmm. I just like comedy. And so that gave me a little bit more freedom to say, okay, I can step back and I can be a little bit more, you know, objective about this and say, you know, what do I like? Who's making a lot of noise? Without any of the baggage that I know sometimes happens when, you know, you have performers. You know, there's none of the relationship stuff. There's none of the preconceived notions. So, you know, there's some people who, you know, I've written about who I know there's personal animosities within the Twin Cities comedy scene between them and other comics. And, you know, it's funny because I'll write about somebody and then, you know, there somebody will respond or they'll write me a note and they'll say, well, why'd you talk about this and this and this person? I'll be like, because they're funny, because they're doing something interesting. And for the most part, people understand that. And I think actually people kind of appreciate that to a degree, you know, because I'll turn around and write a story about the next person who I think is funny, regardless of what their affiliation or their home club or their whatever the case is. And I think that that's something that, you know, and again, I guess I don't have a great comparison because it's not like I know all the comedy beat writers in other towns, but I feel like that's something that's very important in helping to develop the comedy scene. You know, I mean, this piece of assistance that I can give in building this Minnesota comedy scene, I think, is being able to provide some objectivity in that I love comedy. I want to be able to help grow it, but I just want to be able to say, look, are you doing something interesting? Are you doing something funny? Are you doing something unique? Great. Let's talk about it. You know, you're a great example. You know, you and me talks because this show, I think, is phenomenal. I think it's a great idea, you know, that you have this podcast specifically about bombing. And you know, you do things that are really unique and interesting and cutting edge. And that's why I want to talk to you, you know, and it's not because, oh, you know, Dan is a, he's a regular at this club. And so, you know, you got to make sure you get in good with these guys at this club. It's just, you're great at what you do. You have something unique to say. You're doing it in an interesting way. And I think that's what's allowed me to kind of, you know, continue to flourish and kind of given me the, for lack of a better term, kind of the respect to be able to keep doing this and to be able to look at as somebody that people want to talk to and the people want to, you know, want to pitch their ideas to.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I totally agree with what you're saying about that. Just from what I've known of you, because I, you know, some of the people that I've seen you do spotlight, you know, write-ups about, I'm just like, wow, that's really cool. Because, you know, in comedy, and it's not to be offensive to any of them, it's just what it is, in comedy, they're nobodies. Nobody knows these people. You know what I mean? Like, they barely, some of these people that you talk to have barely been doing comedy for a minute. And I think that's great, because a lot of times what you do see, you know, and I've traveled around and lived in other cities and stuff, and a lot of times your entertainment reporters are, you know, they're either trying to get into comedy themselves, like you said, so they have ulterior motives, or they only want to talk to the people who not necessarily are up and coming, but are already up, you know, like either the traveling celebrity comics that are coming through the town, or the top people in the scene. Those are the only people that they care about. And that's something I've seen with you, where it's not like that. You're very open to, like, you're about the whole scene, not just, you know, like you said, you know, necessarily loyal to one club or cliques or things like that, which I can appreciate that. I really can.
No, I appreciate that. Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, and don't get me wrong, it's funny because, you know, and I appreciate that you say that. And I try, you know, and again, and I'm saying this to you, like, you don't know. I mean, comedy is so subjective, where it's like, you know, something that's going to be funny or interesting or unique to one person might not be that to the next.
Yep.
So I do at least, you know, for the most part, keep my personal biases out of it from a, hey, what do I think is funny standpoint, and try to focus more on, you know, some of those things that are undeniable. So, like, you know, who's doing it consistently? Who is, you know, finding new ways to get out there? Who is, you know, offering a unique perspective? You know, there's people who I've spotlighted, who I've written about, who I, you know, have good relationships with, who, you know, I'll be honest, like, from a comedy standpoint, they don't do much for me. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll shows and I'm like, okay, they're fine, but, like, I'm not, you know, like, oh my gosh, I'm a super fan or anything, but I respect what they're doing. And I think that they're, you know, their work ethic, and just, you can tell they're talented and that they care. And that's really what I think, to me, that's what's most interesting. And that's what really connects with me the most and makes me want to talk to people. So, I mean, there's so many people too, on the flip side, who are incredible. They kill the first time out. And you're like, I don't believe that this person hasn't been doing comedy for 10 years. But if they're just kind of casually like, yeah, you know, go to an open mic, or somebody wants to book me, I don't really talk to them as much. And it's not because they're not great, and it's not because they're not talented, but it's like, you know, especially in the Twin Cities, where people are so creative and always looking for new ways to, you know, new perspectives and new ways to talk about things and all this stuff. I think that it's important. It's just as important how you're presenting yourself and the ways that you're going about presenting yourself and getting out there as it is the actual content of the comedy that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I totally agree with that. I mean, mm-hmm. and it goes back, like, talking about people who do comedy casually. It's like, oh, sure, you can do a spotlight because they're funny or whatever, but then what does that do for them if they're not actually trying to go do comedy, you know? Because ultimately you're trying to be a support person in the comedy scene to where you want people to, you know, you spotlight people because you want the readers to go see them people live and support the things they're doing. So totally makes sense that, you know, if a comic isn't really trying or doing anything, it's almost pointless to try to spotlight them other than to, you know, rub their ego, I guess.
Yep, absolutely. And it's funny, too. I mean, the last thing I can say about it, we can move on. But, like, you know, I've interviewed the, like you said, some of the national comics, the big names. Celebrities that have come through town who've done comedy, and 9 times out of 10, I'll be honest with you, it's not a bad conversation, but it's just not that interesting of a conversation because, you know, they're there to promote, they're there to sell tickets, right?
Yep.
So, you know, and they'll be polite and they'll might be funny and they'll, you know, they'll talk to you, but you're not really necessarily getting a lot of insight into, you know, what are they trying to do? Like, why are they doing this? Like, what makes their comedy unique? Like, how are they trying to connect with their audiences? They're just like, hey, how many people can I pack into a club here this weekend? You know? So that's another reason why, you know, don't get me wrong. Like, I mean, I've had a lot of fun talking to some of those, you know, bigger names that people know. You know, there's some big names that have come through that have been absolutely fantastic. And there's some big names too that come through that you can tell are so well coached and they know what they're doing where it's like, good and it's funny, but it almost feels like you're watching a bit. Like, it feels like you're watching comedy a little bit when you talk to him because you're like, you do the same set every time you go to. You know, like Jeff Ross, I interviewed one time, was fantastic, but I was like, he does this same interview 8 times a day. Like, I know it.
Yeah.
When you talk to somebody who's, you know, really, you know, they're still developing, they're still trying to cut their teeth and they're still trying to work at it. You can feel, I mean, like you just kind of talked about with your first time going up and doing comedy, like you can feel that they're like, this is what I want to do. And I'm genuinely passionate about it. And I love doing it. And that's what I like to talk about. That's what I like to write about, because I think regardless of if I think that person is funny or not funny or whatever the case is, that's what I think is the most entertaining and most interesting part of comedy in general, is just seeing people's motivations, understanding their perspective and understanding why they do this. And that's what I love to do. So yeah, I mean, if Andrew Dice Clay comes to town and he wants to chat with me about the old days of comedy and he wants to do Hickory Dickory Dock jokes to me, I'll listen. I'll write that stuff up. But I'm way more interested in somebody who's going down and doing 4 open mics a week right now. And, you know, they're still trying to figure out how to break through and get a solid 5 minutes together. I think that's really interesting to me because I'm like, you know, that takes perseverance. That takes a lot of heart and it takes a lot of, you know, I give all the comics in the world a lot of credit who can stick with it, yourself and others included, because, man, just the drive to keep going sometimes.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely incredible. You know, I've said to others, like, I don't know if I could go up and bomb 4 out of my first 5 times and be like, yeah, I should still keep doing this. There's no reason why I shouldn't keep doing this thing. Like, 5 times at it, and I've done it 4 times, or I've done, you know, 5 or 6 times, I don't want to do it anymore. I'm like, well, sucks. So I'm always so impressed with people who are like, I understand this part of the process, I got to stick it out. So no, I think that's really interesting. I think it's a great part of comedy. I love talking about.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's funny you say that, talking about the drive and stuff, because it's like every day, you know, one of the questions I feel like, and I feel like most comics ask it themselves, is this the day I quit comedy? Is this the day I just call it throw in the towel? Oh, that's great. Now I'm curious, you know, talking about, you know, in relationship to like bombing and things like that, have you ever had like with a big celebrity, and you don't have to name names, I don't care, I'm just curious, because I've had this talking on this podcast that some people are just hard to interview. Have you had an interview where it was just, and basically it was like a bomb because you just couldn't like connect with the person?
Oh yeah, let's name names. Let's do it. No, I'm all for it. No, I mean, there's some who, and it's funny because, like, we talked about whose fault is it, right? So, like, there's been some where it was, in my opinion, very clearly their fault. So, like, some people, you can tell they just either they didn't feel like talking, they've done this interview so many times that it was just kind of like, eh, whatever the case are. And some of them were really surprising to me. So, like, for example, here are some great examples. So Nick Kroll's one example. He came here doing stand-up a couple of years ago, and this was back when he was doing Kroll Show. So this was before, like, Big Mouth and things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a fan. I think he's funny. I've liked him on The League, and I've seen his stand-up. And I get on the phone, and you would have thought that I dragged this man out of bed. Like, you would have thought that I was forcing him to have, like, you know, the worst conversation of his life, because every answer was just, yeah, I guess, you know, this is what I do. So, Nick, you know, tell me, I mean, do you feel like when you do stand up, like, people want to see your characters? Do you feel like you can still, like, just kind of do jokes? I mean, what's kind of the pressure like? You know, whatever people want to see.
Oh, jeez.
Cool, Nick. So, like, those have been bombs. But then there's the flip side where I have definitely been responsible for the bomb. and which, you know, this is one where someday if I ever meet her, I'm going to need to – I owe her an apology. Elizabeth – what's her name? Jesse Spano from Saved by the Bell. So Elizabeth Berkley, is that her name?
Oh, yeah. Elizabeth.
Yeah. Yeah, Elizabeth Berkley. That's her. But so she was coming to town, and she had written a book that was like a real, like, positive self-empowerment for girls type book. Very cool thing. And so she was coming to the Mall of America, and I was like, okay, great. I'm going to interview her. I want to talk to her. And her publicist told me ahead of time, they were like, listen, don't ask about Showgirls. Like, don't do it, because obviously it's an easy, like, punching down thing, because, you know, it was a movie everybody's made fun of, mm-hmm. and it's a different time in her life. Well, I'm probably 30 years old at this point, and I'm just like, oh no, this is going to be great. This is going to be so great. I'm going to ask her about it, and it's going to be this big, like, jaw drop moment. And so I asked it, and I asked him, I don't remember what I asked specifically, but I brought up the movie, which I was specifically told not to do. And it was literally like, have you ever said something and immediately felt bad about yourself the second it came out of your mouth because the reaction was so bad?
Oh yeah.
Oh man. It was like I thought, I was like, okay, either, you know, I'm thinking I'm Captain Shock Jock or something. I'm like, okay, she's going to get mad and hang up on me, or we're going to get an argument, or something salacious is going to happen. And she was so nice, but you could tell that her feelings were so hurt, and it just brought the conversation to a screeching halt. And there was no coming back. You know, we couldn't be like, okay, so let's pivot to Saved by the Bell. Like, it was just like I had bummed out the whole conversation.
Oh, no.
And, you know, to her credit, like, she was still peppy and gave, like, the right answers. But I was just like, oh, my God, that was so bad. And I remember after that day, I promised myself, I was like, you know what? That was when, as an interviewer, I was like, it's important to still appreciate and respect people as people, which sounds really, like, shitty to say that way. But it's true. I think a lot of times, especially with celebrities, it's really easy to think, you know, especially celebrity culture, oh, you know, they're used to, I can say X, Y, and Z, and I can say and do whatever I want because they don't care. It bounces off of them. And that was one of the first times that I was like, oh, man, I said something I really shouldn't have said there. And it wasn't even super mean-spirited. It was just one of those things where it was like, I shouldn't have done it, and mm-hmm. I can't. And so I had to pay the price for it. And so that taught me a lot about interviewing people, whether it was comedians or celebrities or whatever the case they do, are to be like, hey, look, have a conversation with this person first instead of whatever, pushing my agenda or something, right? And I mean, yeah. To kind of bring back comedy, obviously it's a little bit different, but, you know, it's like one of those things. And, you know, you and I were talking a little even before we started recording about, like, clean comedy. I think a lot of times it's, you know, it's not like you necessarily always need to be squeaky clean just because that's what you have to do. But sometimes knowing, like, what's an okay and appropriate thing to say versus what's, you know, like, what's not going to go over. Like, if you're just saying a bunch of crazy stuff to an audience and it starts to bomb, that's on you. And yep. That was what I was essentially in this situation was, you know, I went into business for myself. I was more interested in my own, like, oh, this is going to be funny. This will be great. As opposed to what made the most sense in that conversation. And I paid. So that would be the best bomb story I can think of. your viewing perspective is concerned.
Yeah, that's one thing that I kind of learned fast, not just with, you know, doing the podcast, just like when I started doing comedy, you know, especially because I moved out to California for a while, so I had plenty of opportunities where you would work with celebrity comics, and I tried to – I've always tried to be respectful of people just because that's, you know, how I was raised. But it's one of the things I learned is that the and people often forget, it's just what you said, they're people too. They're not – they're just regular people. They're not anything special. Yes, they've been, you know, they're famous for the stuff that they've done because we live in a society that, you know, gives entertainers all the accolades and fame or whatever. But at the end of the day, they're just a regular person. They're going to go home. They're going to, you know, be with their family, or if they have family, they eat like everybody else, you know, like they're just people, and they just want to be treated like people and treated like such. So.
Yeah. Nope, I totally agree with you.
Definitely
so.
A good takeaway. Now,
yeah,
I know that, and I'm not very familiar with that particular newspaper because I haven't lived in the cities very long. But I know you wrote for a newspaper for quite a while. Was it City Beat? Was that the name of it, or
City Pages? Yep.
Okay, City Beat was a paper similar to that, but in San Diego.
Okay.
That's why I'm thinking of City Beat. City Beat was it was a San Diego City Beat, which is very similar to the City Pages.
Sure, but, the alt weekly out there. I get you.
Yeah, yeah. So then after that shut down, you started Minnesota Comedy to keep doing, you know, content and articles and things about comedy. How has that been going for you, and what inspired you to keep going with that?
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. You know, there was a minute there where I kind of felt like the Grim Reaper of alternative media out here because, you know, City Pages has this long, you know, 40-year history in the Twin Cities, and they shut down this year because of the pandemic. There was another magazine that was around for a better part of a decade called The Growler that focused a lot more on, like, breweries and kind of, like, that brewer culture. But they also did a lot of, you know, arts and entertainment, so I wrote all the comedy stuff for them. They shut down this year, so it was like, okay, like... where else am I going to talk to? But my main motivation for doing it, you know, it's twofold. Number one, kind of back to what we've talked about, I like writing about comedy. I like talking to comedians. I like telling these stories. You know, some guys play fantasy football. I write about comics. So that's kind of what I've always liked to do. So that was part of it. But then the other thing is, and this probably sounds like I'm trying to give myself too much self-importance, but there really, I don't believe, is another media entity out here that's really talking about stand-up comedy regularly, you know, that's really giving stand-up comics the opportunity to really, like, get their names out there. I think, you know, and obviously this will be another challenge, but I think music is one of those things that gets covered a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's so, right? Because, you know, there's a lot of great bands and every town has its own local scene and things like this. But a lot of times, you know, comics kind of get overlooked. And it's funny that Louis Anderson actually said to me, he was like, yeah, he's like, you know, stand-up comedy's kind of looked at. He goes, we're looked at as the lowest common denominator of entertainment sometimes. He was like, you know, people will look at a band that's been out for 3 months and be like, oh, they're really hustling out there and they've got a hit and they're doing this and this and this. You can be a stand-up comic who's doing 6 nights a week and people are like, yeah, he's some guy who's in a bar telling jokes or something. You know, it doesn't get the respect all the time. So to me, it was important to carry that on, to help give more spotlight to some of these individuals, you know, whether it's people who have been a little bit more established, who are doing, you know, albums or specials or headlining gigs. And, you know, like you and I just talked about, people who, you know, have been doing the open mic scene for a while, or people who are just kind of starting to get their first, to get their feet wet in the road gigs a little bit, or whatever the case is, and really just kind of keep that alive, you know, let people know that, hey, we still have this really thriving comedy scene. And, you know, regardless of what happens, comedy is still alive and well in Twin Cities. And I think that that's something that's really important. And that's something that I've been trying to kind of get across through the last few months of, MN Comedy. So that was kind of the thought behind that.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Because I totally agree with how a lot of media outlets hardly ever cover comedy. It goes back to what we're talking about. If they do, they're usually only interested in the big celebrities that are coming through and doing write-ups on, not necessarily supporting the local scene. So it's good that, it's good that the Twin Cities have that. And I hope other comics in the Twin Cities really appreciate that because, you know, there's a lot of other areas where you don't have that, you know, to have a good scene, you need to have good support from different outlets. You know, you have to have venues that support comedy. You have to have, you know, entertainment and arts and culture writers that support comedy and you know, things like that. So that's really cool that you're keeping that going. Now, totally. I know we probably should finish up here a little bit before we do. I want to really talk about this because this is a thing that really doesn't get covered very often in comedy, except maybe in LA, but the history of comedy. You have a book coming out that is specific to Minnesota that mm-hmm. covers the history of Minnesota comedy, which I think is fantastic. Talk about that a little. What inspired you to write that, or how did that project come along?
I appreciate it. So yeah, the book's called Funny Thing About Minnesota. It's out now through the Minnesota Historical Society Press. And this has been, gosh, better part of 2 years this project's been coming together. You know, it's one of those things where Historical Society actually initially reached out to me and just kind of floated the idea. They said, hey, you know, we've done all these books, kind of going back, like we just talked about with music, right? Like we've talked about the history of music in the Twin Cities and the Minnesota sound and all these important contributions that Minnesota's made to music as a whole. We've never really talked about comedy. And, you know, it's funny because I think if you talk to a lot of comedians, there's kind of this, you know, there's this grand kind of like, what's the word I'm looking for here? There's kind of this aura around Twin Cities comedy. You know, you hear people talk about Minnesota comedy and it's like, oh man, it's, you know, it's this really important scene and the audiences are so good.
Like
and
the clubs lore. Are so good.
Comics, the lore. Thank
yeah,
you. Exactly.
Lore.
So you hear about this, but I don't know that you always necessarily understand, like, where did that come from? Like, why is that? I mean, you know the big names, right? Like, everybody, when you hear Minnesota, you think of Louis Anderson, you think of Maria Bamford, and you think of Mitch Hedberg, and you think of Liz Winstead and things like that. But I think kind of similar to what you and I have been talking about here, a lot of times it's like, okay, well, I know the big names, but like, what's the real deal behind this whole backstory and lore and history and things like that? So when they said that to me, I kind of said, all right, well, let's set out and let's do the research. And so, you know, I spent the next year, you know, interviewing and researching and reading, and really came back to finding the, you know, learning more about the history, which was pretty interesting just from a guy who likes stand-up comedy standpoint. You know, it's been fascinating, but it's a pretty incredible story. You know, the lore is justified. That's mm-hmm. what I can say. It's funny because, you know, you hear about, like I said, these different like people, like Louis Anderson's a great example, right? But to hear his story and to hear some of the other comics and people who, you know, kind of helped him to get to this point, it's fascinating. So, you know, you go back to like the late 70s, which is kind of when stand-up comedy started here. And you had this bar over in kind of the North Loop area of Minneapolis called Mickey Finn's. It was in the basement of a Union Bar. And so you had Louis and you had guys like Scott Hansen, who owned, you know, a bunch of clubs out here that were massive during the 80s. You know, other names that are still quite a – sorry.
That was the greatest.
Trying to make a sales pitch here, and the cat's killing me. But you get, I mean, like, you hear these names, right? I mean, like, you know, Jeff Cesario and Bill Bauer and Alex Cole and all these different names. And so it was really fascinating to hear about, you know, how did this start? Because at that point, outside of, you know, like LA or New York, there wasn't stand-up comedy. It wasn't just like a common thing. You couldn't just go to any town and go hit a club, right? I mean, it mm-hmm. wasn't. So these guys just kind of, they knew they wanted to do stand-up, but nobody had kind of set that roadmap. So they kind of created their own roadmap, and it just built and built and built from there. And so it was just really cool. It was really interesting. And the more that I kind of dug in, the more layers there were to it. You know, once you learn about kind of the original guys and how they got started over Mickey Finn's, then you hear more about some of the other personalities who came along and started other rooms. You know, there was a place called the Comedy Cabaret where Stephanie Hodge, who's major player out in Hollywood, still a major player out in Hollywood, you know, that's where she got her start. You hear about, you know, Dudley Riggs, obviously. You could write 3 books about Dudley Riggs and what he did over at the Experimental or the ETC. And, you know, how he started some different stand-up comedy groups out there and just all these different things that happened. And And it's just, it's pretty fascinating to see how this thing just blew up and exploded. And then to see how Minnesota comedy influenced other towns. You know, one thing which, you know, I'm sure this is probably debated, but Minnesota, in essence, kind of created the MC feature headliner structure of stand-up comedy clubs. Because up until that point, even if you went to LA or New York and you went to the Improv or whatever the case are, you kind of just had a hodgepodge showcase structure, right? Like you'd be like, yeah, oh,
yeah. Still do for a lot.
Yeah,
lot of
exactly.
Times.
Absolutely. And I mean, yeah, you've been out. I mean, you were in LA. So, you know, I mean, even if you go to the, you know, places like the Comedy Store, or, you know, the Improv or wherever the case is, it's not like it's structured like, oh, one guy's going to do 45 minutes and the MC is going to do 15 and the feature is going to do 25. And so Minnesota is where they really started doing that, where they said, well, if we're going to bring in these guests and we're going to have, you know, people who are going to develop, let's set a structure up so people can kind of start to progress and grow. And that was another thing that I didn't realize, you know, came out of Minnesota. So really, you know, I'm rambling, but I would say learning not just about the history and not just the people, but also the contributions that Minnesota comedy just kind of made to the comedy world as a whole was super fascinating. So I think whether you're a, you know, I think if people who are listeners of this podcast, I think are probably in that same boat. You know, if you're a comedy nerd and you love hearing about this stuff, absolutely for you. But also, I think if you're somebody who likes a lot of these, you know, individuals, you know, you've heard of the Louis Andersons and the Liz Winsteads and, you know, people who came through here who you don't necessarily know about. You know, Tom Arnold played a huge role in Twin Cities comedy. And, you know, there's some great stories in this book about, you know, everybody from when Jay Leno came to town, Jerry Seinfeld came out here, you know, Jay and Jerry both, they weren't really that well established yet. And they were getting some of their first big sets in Minnesota. So hearing stories about them and then hearing about, you know, even folks like, you know, when you and I, before we came on here, we were talking about people who are very clean, squeaky clean on stage, off stage. And it's like, whoa, incredible story in this book about Drew Carey. Drew Carey, who, you know, if you ever see a stand-up, squeaky clean guy, very funny. Some of the stories about when Drew Carey would come to town and what Carey off stage are fantastic. So, like, you know, we get into stuff like that. So a lot of really cool stuff. I mean, whether you're into comedy, whether you're a comedy nerd, or whether you're somebody who just wants to kind of get to know, you know, some of the funnier stories about what it's like to be in Minnesota.
Yeah. Well, and that's great. I feel like more comedy scenes, like when there are scenes, like there's history with these a lot of, especially because it's one thing that's really interesting about comedy and comedy scenes specifically is that you have classes of comics, you know, like like a group of comics start doing open mics and then they start moving up the ladder of comedy if they stick with it, and then all of a sudden a new class comes along and starts doing open mics and they become kind of buddies, and it keeps going, and it's like this constant thing that keeps developing. And so every so many years there's a new class of comedians, and you know, and it just keeps going. And as that happens, a lot of the newer comics, they don't know what had to happen so that they could have these opportunities. You know, I've had conversations when I lived in San Diego, you know, there's a comic that, Patrick DeGeer is, you know, within the scene, like the comics that have been doing comedy a long time really knew who he was because, you know, he's worked the road, he's been on TV, he's did a bunch of stuff, but a lot of the newer comics have no clue who he is because he's not out doing the open mics or whatever. And, but he's one of the people that helped, you know, pave the way for there to be a scene in San Diego comedy. And, and that's just one example, but it's like, I, you know, and I've had conversations with him about that, is that a lot of these scenes, there's no collection of history. So like if somebody new comes into comedy, they can't just be like, well, how did this even start? You know, like where do you even, you know, it's all lore. You hear things from comics that gets passed around, but then that ends up being like telephone where the stories change and get embellished and and everything that. So,
and the funny thing is that even happens with people who were there. I mean, as I was even interviewing and putting this book together, you know, you'd have a talk with one comedian and they'd give you kind of the whole story. And then you talk to somebody else who was there and you'll get other details would change. The lore would grow. All of a sudden, like, oh, this was a much bigger deal. You know, one of the earliest stories in the book we talk about, which is kind of one of the big question marks in Minnesota comedy lore, was, you know, Wild Bill Bauer, who's one of the original comics out here, and Scott Hansen, who's one of the original comics out here as well, who all still part of these clubs. There's a big kind of mythical story about a fist fight that they got into one night. And legend has it that they got into this big fist fight and Scott was like, you know what? I'm done. I quit. I'm not doing comedy anymore. He left. And had he not left, you know, he probably wouldn't have gone out and started his own comedy clubs. He wouldn't have started, you know, the comedy cabarets that became the Scott Hansen's comedy galleries. Now, if you hear Scott Hansen tell the story, there was no fight. He's like, there was no fist fight. We had some words. Nothing happened. If you talk to others, it's, oh, Bill Bauer dragged him up a flight of stairs by the head and he tossed him outside. And this, you know, there was drugs and there was cops and there was all this stuff. So depending on whose version of the story, the lore grows.
Oh, that's great.
One is real.
One version, one version, it's just a little argument. And another version, it was a pro wrestling event.
Literally. I've heard everything from we had a disagreement and, you know, we were arguing to some saying that Louis Anderson himself had to block the staircase so that nobody could see just how wild this fist fight was getting. Like, I've heard everything in between these two. So it's stuff like that, that, like you said, the lore is really interesting, but it's also interesting to hear from the people who were there. And I mean, this stuff is happening 40 years ago. So I assume some of it, the truth is probably in the middle. And I did my best going through this book to give as much of that as I possibly could. But even the individuals who are there, I feel like maybe have different perspectives of how it went down.
Yeah. So it's I'll bet. Oh, and I have a question about that. That's a good, how did you take that? Like, you know, you said you're trying to do a good job to capture that, but did, when you're telling a story of something that happened that really impacted the comedy and you have all these different perspectives and their versions of the story, how do you kind of put it together to be like, well, this must be it? Or is it more of a situation where you're like, well, if you talk to so-and-so, this is kind of what happened, but if you talk to so-and-so, this is what happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it depended on the story, obviously, and it depended on just how wildly different the versions were. And a lot of times, you know, early on, I was talking to one of the comics who's on the cover, Jeff Gerbino. He and I talked, and he said, look, print whatever you're going to print. Whatever you hear, that's fine, good, bad, or otherwise. He said, here's my only thing. He goes, do it from people who were there. He was like, avoid the hearsay, avoid the stories. Like, if somebody says they were there and here's what they saw, that's what happened. So for the most part, I tried to follow that. So if somebody said, hey, look, I was there and here's what happened and I experienced it, then I'll put, you know, that's fact. If there was something where somebody said, well, here's what I heard happened, I might include it, but I'd obviously make sure that people knew, hey, like, he wasn't there. This is just kind of what the rumor was at the time.
Gotcha.
And some of those stories were easier to kind of reconcile than others, right? One of the famous stories in here is between Louis Lee, who owns Acme Comedy Company, and Scott Hansen, who was kind of the kingpin of comedy out here at the time. You know, they started in a club together. Like, Louis and Scott were partners in one of the original comedy gallery locations out here. And there, I mean, I won't get into the whole story because it would take us a while, but there was a car accident and there was money and there was a implication by one person that the other person had ties to the Chinese mafia. And jeez. Crazy things.
These are good, like, selling, you know, what points. I
hear, yeah, I know. But when you hear, like, okay, so you're saying that he has ties to the Chinese mafia, I'm like, I need to call and I need to say, hey, this is what I heard, you know? And for the most part, I like to give everybody the opportunity to try to explain their side of the story. And then I just kind of say, hey, look, to your point, here's what he said. Here's what he said. You form your own conclusions.
Yeah, no, that's great. I look forward to reading it. I'm very excited about this book, especially, you know, even though I'm not new to comedy, I am new to the Minnesota, you know, the Twin Cities comedy scene. And so learning the history about it, to me, that's very exciting. I'm looking forward to it. I hope this book does really well. And I hope a lot of comics, not just in the Twin Cities, but all over, you know, get this book because it's all part of the comedy history in general. Yeah,
so definitely.
It's definitely.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think that's another interesting part. And like I said, even if you're not from Minnesota and some of these Minnesota names mean nothing to you, I think hearing about how these things, you know, kind of came about is really important. And even hearing about the personalities, you know, some of the Minnesota personalities who have stories about kind of bigger acts, it's interesting. You know, even one gentleman who everybody in Minnesota is familiar with is Fancy Ray McCloney. And Fancy Ray, you know, when, granted, he's always Fancy Ray, but when you can get Fancy Ray to tell you about some of these old days, it's really fascinating. You know, he'll tell you about opening for Chris Rock, or having Chris Rock open for him, rather, I should say, you know, back in those days, what Chris Rock was like. And just, it's kind of like we had talked about at the beginning of this, when you see behind the curtain and you realize, oh, these larger than life people are real people and they have a real history and a real backstory. It's fascinating, you know, hearing about Jay Leno coming into town. And one story that didn't make the book because it just got too long in the tooth is, you can cut this if you want, but Jay Leno came to town. And I don't know if you've ever heard of Shinders. Shinders was a bookstore in Minnesota that, I mean, has a long history. Everybody knows it. And it was, you know, your old school bookstore. It had magazines, had car stuff, and it also had a very extensive adult section. And the story about Jay Leno, which I loved, which I'm going to tell you this one, is, so Jay was a car guy. So Jay, he's always been a car guy. He's famous for being a car guy. So he came here for his very first time. He goes to town, you know, comes to Minnesota. He's got nothing else to do. And they say, oh, there's a bookstore. You know, they got all these car magazines. You should go check it out. So Jay Leno walks down to Shinders. He's in there. He's reading his car mags. And I don't remember which station it is, but a local TV station shows up, like, caught in the act style, to basically be like, local perverts busted in bookstore, adult buying adult materials. And Jay Leno, who's just starting to really get like a reputation together, and he's like, oh no. So, fortunately for Jay, he got out. They didn't interview him. He's not on camera. But that's one of those stories, again, where I'm like, you don't hear this kind of stuff about guys like Jay Leno. I assume he's got, you know, he's got chips like you and me who go out and buy him car magazines now, or whatever the case is. So to hear, you know, stories about people who, you know, to know everybody came from somewhere, everybody's had insane things happen to them, and everybody has these really great backstories, I think that's one of the coolest parts of this book. It was the coolest part of writing the book for me. I hope it's the coolest part of reading the book for other people.
Oh, fantastic. And just, I got a couple things before we finish up, but as long as we're talking about the book, where can people find the book?
Sure. So if you're in Minnesota, it's in all bookstores. So, you know, some of the smaller ones, it's taken a little more time to get there, but I mean, it's everywhere from, you know, Barnes and Noble to your, your smaller, you know, Half Price Books and Moon Palace Books and places like that. You can go to, there's a site called IndieBound where you can actually pull up all the local bookstores that have it in your area. Target will have it. Costco will have it locally. If you're outside of Minnesota, you can get it online through either the Historical Society Press's website, which is mnhs.org. Otherwise, there's a site called bookstore.org that actually pulls and helps support indie bookstores. So you can order through there, or you can give Bezos your money and go through Amazon, whatever you want to do. So
I feel like you're judging me because that's what I did. The way you looked at me when you said that. And then now, after hearing all these other independent businesses I could have supported, I'm just like, oh, I failed.
Hey, here's the deal. You know what? Here's my thought, Dan, and I'm sure I'm going to catch flack for this. Anybody who says that they've got a problem with Amazon is lying to you, because especially this year, we have all become Amazon Prime's biggest customers.
Okay? Yep.
Everything from Bezos now. I don't care. I can go down to the store and get something right now. I'm going to order on Amazon. I'm going to get delivered in 3 hours because I can. Like,
yep, yep.
Jeff Bezos, thank you.
Well, now he's done. So
that's true. Now it's whoever's next.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I do personally, because I used to own a business. So, like, if I can support locally, I try to support locally the best I can. But yeah, I still order stuff on Amazon all the time. It's part of our culture now.
Hey, man, selfishly, you know, as a supporter of Minnesota, I hope people will go out and support those indie bookstores and things like that. Selfishly, as somebody who just wants somebody to read my book, go to your house and give you the book for half price. Do it. Call it. I don't care. Just get the book. So.
Get the book. Read the book. Oh, that's fantastic. Exactly. All right. Well, we talked a little bit about some of the bombing stories and different things. I'm not going to get into a lot of the same routine questions that I do on this podcast because it doesn't really apply. But I am curious, as far as all the different – and. Your book aside, okay, let's put that aside. Your book aside, what to you has been your favorite thing that you've written?
Ooh, man, that's a tough question. That's a good one. I like that. I'll break into two ones. You know, number one, I think favorite things I've written, And again, RIP City Pages, which fortunately City Pages is going to be all archived over from the Minnesota Historical Society now, so I can talk about this stuff and people can actually read it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, the site had been taken down and all this stuff, but it will be there. So, you know, I had the opportunity to do a lot of stories with City Pages where we would talk about, you know, not just in comedy, but people who have unique stories and they do things that are a little bit different. And I'll tell you, my very first ever cover story I did for City Pages, I actually went, I don't know if you know this, but in East Bethel, Minnesota, there's a nudist colony. And it is, yeah, it's a campground in East Bethel, Minnesota.
No clue.
Yep, nudist colony. And years ago, I went there because they were part of a coordinated effort with other nudist colonies in the country to set the world record for the world's largest collective skinny dipping. And so that part was insane. But it was funny. So I went there. It was me and a photographer. We went there together, which, let me tell you, I think that's the only time in any profession, I guess, except maybe like the adult professions, where, you know, being naked with your coworker, it's just like a part of the job. It was cool. He and I were just two cool dudes hanging out naked. But, you know, we went through this whole campground and we interviewed people of all different, you know, ages and sizes and things like that, and kind of talked to them about their motivations. And it was fascinating because, you know, I think when you hear, you know, nudist colony, you know, it has, you know, very, we'll say it has a very loaded perception, right?
Yep. Like,
it's this wild, you know, orgy and all this other stuff. If you ever went camping with like your parents growing up, or you take your kids camping now and you go to the campground where everybody's just hooking up there, you know, there are little electrical boxes and stuff. It's the same thing, except everybody's naked. So that was really fascinating. That was a whole nother world I had never been to.
They're people too. Is that what you're telling me?
They're just people too, but they just don't want to wear clothes. So that was an interesting one. I really enjoyed that. So, I mean, there's a few like that. You know, there's a whole group, a pretty significant group out here of furries, you know, people who wear the full fur suits in Minnesota. So I went to their big picnics and I got the opportunity to hang out with the furries for the day. And that was a wild one.
There was actually in San Diego, there was a comic that actually he started doing comedy in a furry costume. Because apparently the person that made the costume, he claimed was sponsoring him and paying him every time he performed in it, even though he was just doing open mics. He wasn't doing like book shows. And I always thought it would have been funny if he would have like did the comedy as the character or as the furry. But he was like just in the costume and he was doing like jokes about his real life. So it like just didn't make sense to me. Like it just... I was just like, and I told him, I was like, this is kind of funny, but you should be your character, not who you really are. Cause now people just, they can't connect.
I don't know if I could take like a 6 foot lizard seriously. Who's like, so you guys know what's tough about dating? And it's like, I'm a 6 foot lizard. Like what is tough about it?
So. My short arms. Yeah.
Oh man. That's funny. That would be something to see. So
yeah, I saw some of the craziest things at open mics when I lived in San Diego. And I suppose LA probably gets the same, and New York and LA both probably get it. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, one open mic, somebody was up, he went up as in a devil costume. And, you know, I've seen all kinds of weird costumes and just different things. It's just like, I don't even know what this is.
Oh, man. I'm sure it's a whole other world out there. I mean, I've seen some weird ones out here, but that I've never seen a furry. I would love to see that person go to sign up for the open mic, too. That would be my favorite part, to see them show up in, like, full costume, like, cool, man. All right. What's
well, you know, what's funny about it is that what he would do is he'd come and sign up, and then he'd go into the bathroom and put his costume on.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's crazy things, man. Comedy brings out some crazy, crazy things.
Oh, yeah. The other thing I'll say really fast is, you know, the other thing in terms of favorite thing I've written about from a comedy perspective, you know, I've had the opportunity to see a lot of different things as far as, you know, I was part of Acme Comedy Company, their 20-year anniversary. I got to really hang out there for a whole week and see, you know, meet a lot of the comics who were there from the old days and just kind of see the relationships between the comics. And that was something for me. And I'm not telling you anything you don't know firsthand. I had never seen the camaraderie between comedians before. And that's really cool to me to see too, is when you see comedians get together it's a whole other thing. You know, you can have really close friends if you're a non-comedian. You can have really close friends who are comics, but when comics get together, it's just a different thing.
Yeah. Like, oh, I
kind of relationship. Whether you're really close or not, there's just a different sense of camaraderie. There's a different kind of just even cadence to the way they talk to each other. And that's always been really fascinating for me to see too, is just kind of the way that, you know, comics, it's not that they aren't accepting and nice and all these other great things, but there's just something different about the way comics talk to other comics. It's fascinating to me. So that was a really cool thing to get to experience.
Yeah. And that's very true. I can tell you firsthand, because I've often, you know, like I have friends that don't do comedy and, you know, we hang out and do things or whatever, and it's fine. But even for me, sometimes I'm like, man, I wish I was just hanging out with comics, you know, like, because it is different. It's an interesting thing that the relationships that kind of get formed and bonded with comedy. All right. Well, I got two more things for you, and then I'll let you get out of here. One, I've got the Art of Bombing Get Pumped playlist, and I know you don't, you know, do you're right, but you don't do comedy. But still, is there a song that gets you pumped and ready to write?
Oh man, whew. You know, the one I'll go with right now. So I would do this thing, especially when I was writing the book, where I would just kind of turn on like the YouTube shuffle, like on my TV, and I just have this background. But you know, I won't ask you how old you are because that's rude. But you know, I'm 30.
I'm older than you, so.
Okay, see, there you go. So, well, but you'll appreciate it. Like the first period of music I was super duper into when I was in high school was like that, like late '90s, like alt rock. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So, like, you know, the gosh, this is when you had, like, you know, Better Than Ezra and Tonic and all those, like, one hit wonders that aren't there anymore. So, if I have to pick one, and this is just because I heard it the other day and I thought of it again, do you remember the song Teenage Dirtbag by Wheatus?
Yep.
That's my song. That's the one. That's the jam.
Awesome. It's going in the playlist.
Here we go.
Boom. All right. And the last thing I like to do, I play a game called Pick a Number. You're going to pick a number between 1 and 20. I'm going to ask you a random corresponding question.
Oh, man. All right. Let's go 14.
14. Do you ever stop and think about the number of butts in the world?
Oh, wow. just in general, the number of butts, you know? Yes, I do. And I'll tell you why, Dan, because you know, everybody's got butts. Well, I think everybody's got butts. I don't know.
it's
but,
assumed.
But man, I've got kids and I've got a 5-year-old. And let me tell you, there is nobody who's more psyched about their butt than a 5-year-old. And then he shows me his butt. He wants you to, like, he'll sneak attack you with his butt, Dan. Like, he'll be in the bathroom. He'll be like, Daddy, I need you. And I'll come in there. And he's standing on the toilet, like with his butt spread at me. And I'm just like, what are you doing? And he's just like, what do you see? And I'm like, I see me doing time in jail if this gets misinterpreted. That's what I see. So yeah, man, butts are everywhere in my life, dude. I think about it more than I probably should, but I don't know if I think about it in the poetic way that you put it about just how many are in the world.
Sounds like you think about butts more than you want to.
I was going to say, not my choice. I'm forced to think about the butts.
Oh, this has been great. Final thing, where can people find you and follow you, plug your social media?
Yeah, man, for sure. So you know, mncomedy.com. is the comedy site that I write for. We post several times a week. Like I said, just what's going on locally, shows, podcasts, performers, whatever it is. You can find me on social media there. So, you know, I'm on Twitter at @MinnesotaComedy. Otherwise, Patrick Strait. It's my Instagram. It's my Twitter. I'm easy to find. You know, I don't have a good pseudonym. I think I was too old when I first got social media to come up with something clever or embarrassing. So by the time it was just like Patrick Strait. So if this was 15 years ago and we were doing AIM screen names, I'm sure it'd be a whole other ball game, but
it might even be embarrassed to share it.
Oh, it'd be bad. I'm sure I had several depending on who I was talking to, and I'm sure none of them were good. So
I feel that. All right. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining me.
Awesome, man. No, thank you for having me. I love the show. I love talking to you.
The Art of Bombing is a Blitzed Entertainment production, hosted and produced by me, Dan Bublitz Jr. The stand-up spotlight bumper was produced by Joe Nicola Music. The Art of Bombing theme music was written and performed by John Holt. All other music was used under Creative Commons licensing. All stand-up audio clips were used with permission from the comedians. You can help the podcast by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating, and a review. For previous episodes, merch, blogs, and more, please visit theartofbombingpod.com. And remember, stay safe so you can live to love.